think of the fallen, broken world as normal. In a sense, it's normal for us. But we also know, as Christians, seeing how God created the world, seeing where he's going with the world at Christ's second coming, the restoration of all things, that our world now is not as it's supposed to be and not what it was meant to be. Therefore, the miracles are sort of glimpses of what life restored will be like.
Welcome to Help Me Teach the Bible. I'm Nancy Guthrie. Help Me Teach the Bible is a production of the Gospel Coalition, sponsored by Crossway. Crossway is a not-for-profit publisher of the ESV Bible, Christian books and tracts. Learn more at crossway.org. I came to the other side of the world to get together with the person I'm interviewing today, who doesn't live on the other side of the world from me. Jared Wilson is here in Australia, where we're both speaking at the same conference. Jared, thank you for being willing to sit down with me and to help us teach the Bible.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Excited to be here.
So Jared is the Director of Content Strategy for Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. You're managing editor of For the Church, and you host a podcast for them. You can tell us about that. Also Director of the Pastoral Training Center at Liberty Baptist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. I found this description on your bio. I'm wondering if you wrote it, okay? Because it's not a typical bio kind of statement, this description. It says, Jared is not a catalytic, and it has in quotes, I liked the quotes, agent of change or a visionary anything. He is a failed church planter and once made a mess of his marriage. He likes food too much and worries way too much about what people will think. He's definitely not all that he's cracked up to be. And after 20 years of ministry, he's mainly learned that he's kind of a nincompoop, but he knows Jesus loves him. Did you write that? I did write that.
I don't think I'd let anybody else put that on my website. But it's funny, too. You mentioned that as soon as you said he likes food too much part, I have this high-calorie coffee frap thing right in front of me.
Hey, but so, you know, we've both been speaking all day.
That's
true. We need a little juice.
That's how sin starts, Nancy. I deserve a little bit. So I'm feeling convicted already. This is a great podcast.
This is great. So tell us a little bit more. I read all of those things that you do in Kansas City in relationship to both Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary and then the church that you're a part of. So tell us a little bit more about what you do.
Sure. So for the seminary, I work in the communications department. So my day job, so to speak, is anything related to text, really. So I'm the managing editor for that website for the church. We publish 2 to 3 articles, blog posts, video interviews, Monday through Friday. We even have a devotional from Spurgeon that we take from morning and evening on Sundays as well. So we have Charles Spurgeon blogging for us, which, you know, not a lot of sites
can claim that.
That's right. I also am the managing editor for the seminary's magazine. It comes out twice a year. And just anything related to the sort of message, communication that goes out. I'm a writer-editor, so I have sort of a hand in crafting.
So speaking of Spurgeon,
that's right.
That seminary has a very close connection to Spurgeon.
That's right.
Tell us about that.
So we're the home of the Charles Spurgeon Library. We have 6,000-plus volumes that were part of Spurgeon's personal library. So most of his books, including lots of books that are annotated and have notes and things from him. If he didn't like the author or the book itself, sometimes he would cross out the title and write a new sarcastic title in it.
Seriously, sarcasm by Spurgeon
these books? Oh, no, isn't that a shocker? And we have many artifacts as well. His writing desk, fountain pen, travel desk, the doorknob to his study, his last cigar, actually, a cigar that was in his pocket in Mentone, France when he died, all sorts of things there in the library. So it's a good sort of archive or museum to honor the Prince of Preachers.
Last week, I was looking on Facebook, and I saw Tony Reinke must have been spending some time
at
the seminary because he posted these pictures. He was there. You know, he's a big John Newton guy.
Right.
And he was there in the library, and he found Spurgeon's copy of one of Newton's books.
That's right.
And so it had Spurgeon's marginalia writing comments about Newton. That was pretty fascinating.
Yeah, obviously, you know, it can get a little strange. One of my favorite artifacts is actually Spurgeon's copy of Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. It's a little pocket version, and it's bowed. And the reason, well, we're told the reason that it's bowed is because it was the copy that he kept in his breast pocket, and it's sort of shaped to his chest. So it has this permanent kind of, you know, bow in it. And that's really neat, just the idea that he kind of carried that copy around. Of course, it might have just been warped by the weather, but the other story's better.
I like the other story better, yeah.
Me too.
Well, let's start this way, Jared. Would you just tell us a little bit about how you came to be a person who loves and teaches and writes about God's Word? How did that come about in your life?
Sure. It came really about as an early age. I mean, you know, I was raised in the church, always a very, if I can use the phrase, literary child, reading books, reading stories, and writing stories. Always wanted to be a storyteller before, you know, experiencing a call to ministry and sort of pursuing vocationally ministry, was trying to publish as a novelist. But even just as a child, I would write little stories and staple them together and try to sell them to my friends.
Seriously?
You know? Yes, ma'am. It's just the writing impetus has always been a part of my life as far back as I can remember. So when, you know, pairing that, of course, with being raised in the church and hearing the Bible faithfully taught and preached, those just sort of dovetailed for me. So, you know, I was a Christian leader as a kid as well, the president of my Christian club in high school, and would sometimes teach even the youth Sunday school classes while I was a student and those sorts of things. So it's something that early in I was kind of thrown into. I don't have a lot of formal training in it, so a lot of what I've learned has had to be sort of just sort of independently studied and that sort of thing. But yeah, God's been really gracious and, you know, protected people from me quite a bit and protected me from myself quite a bit. But a lot of the emphasis on the gospel and, you know, the Christocentricity of the Word, a lot of that has come through personal experience, something that, you know, I alluded to in the biography that you read at the beginning of the program, really just a train wreck in my own life where the Lord proved very sweet in a very bitter time for me and for my wife. And in the restoration of that relationship, finding the satisfaction of Christ supreme over all, that just sort of infused with finally a meaning that would satisfy me and I think others.
So you've written a number of books. I didn't bring a list with me.
Okay.
are there one or two books that you think, okay, this is the heartbeat of my ministry?
Yeah, I think I would say, so I wrote a book that was published by Crossway in 2011 called Gospel Wakefulness, and that theme really runs through everything else that I write, and that's really even the theme of my, I think, preaching and teaching ministry as well, just the idea that the gospel is for lost and found alike, that we're not just converted by the gospel, but we're grown by the gospel, and having a growing awakening or realization to just how all-encompassing the grace of God is, the finished work of Christ is. So that's sort of the through line that runs through all of my books. So whatever the topic is, parables, miracles, or what have you, the germ or the, you know, the kernel at the center of it all is how robust and versatile the good news is.
You mentioned that you've always loved to write. And on my flight on the way to Australia, I was reading your book, The Wonderworking God, and there were numerous times I would come to a sentence and sometimes a whole paragraph. And honestly, I was so jealous. I've written a lot of books, but people say, are you a writer? And I can never say that I'm a writer because I feel like I write. But there's a difference in being a writer and being someone who writes, in my view. And so like, when I read some of these paragraphs, I just thought to myself, now Jared, he's a writer.
Well, I appreciate that.
So I appreciate you using your gift that way. So here's one paragraph I read of your book that I just thought was so artfully done. You wrote, because Jesus' very person was the perfect integration of full humanity and full divinity, he carried around with him the growing rift between this world and that one. As he walked, his elbows traced both the air and the ether, stretching the limits of creation, the heavenly gravity pressing in at his movements. Jesus strained the capacity of this world with his very presence. The world's breaches were too small, in other words, for the king of the universe. And we should not be surprised that as the seams split, glory streamed through. That's a great paragraph.
Yeah, is it simple to say I'm a little proud of that paragraph?
It's human to say.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. You know, I do, because my first love really was stories and storytelling, I think I try to bring a kind of literary sensibility to, you know, to nonfiction. And even when I was originally writing for publication, trying to be published as an author, I was writing novels and couldn't get published. And then we planted a church, and through the midst of that, you know, I had an agent that, you know, represented mostly for fiction works, and, you know, we weren't finding much traction. And eventually, you know, he came asking for a manuscript. I said, I can't finish this story because I'm so busy with our church, but I've been preaching through the Gospels and doing this series on the historical Jesus. I could put some stuff together. And he said, you're really a fiction guy. I don't know. You don't have a platform, et cetera, et cetera. I said, this is all I've got. And I put it together and we got a book deal. And, you know, I haven't looked back since then, but I try to, as much as I can, bring in, you know, just the sense of early influences. I mean, when I was a kid, reading Lewis and Tolkien and some of them, and Dickens and others, but even just in high school, Faulkner and Hemingway, and just the ability to turn a phrase that I hope isn't distracting, but now kind of adorns, I think, the beauty of the gospel and adorns the glory of Christ. He's worthy of our best efforts, I think.
Absolutely. Well, I want to talk with you today about this book, The Wonder Working God. You've done a couple on Gospels. You've got the one, The Storytelling God,
right,
where you talk a lot about parables. I read a lot of that one, too. So helpful. We're always struggling to figure out how to handle parables and teach them well. And so not only did you teach the parables, but you handed Bible teachers, I think, in that book, some very helpful tools for approaching parables for our own teaching. But I really want to talk to you about this book, The Wonder Working God, because I think as Bible teachers, sometimes we struggle with how to handle miracle stories. When I think about a lot of the Bible teaching that I sat under for most of my life, it seems like the lesson that was taken away from most miracle stories was, you know, trust God and he'll do this miracle in your life. And so there's that aspect, but I think also what I bring to the miracle stories is my husband David and I have a ministry to grieving parents, and, you know, we'll sit in this circle at our retreats for grieving parents, and they're people who, they've read the Gospels.
Yeah.
And, I mean, what stands out on the pages of the Gospels more than healing miracles? And so, you know, they see Jesus' ability to do a miracle, and they believe in prayer, and they're praying, and it seems like all their friends and people from all over the world oftentimes are praying for their child, and then they don't get the miracle.
Right.
And so often, because they haven't perhaps understood how to read and understand these miracles to put them in context, what you do so beautifully, I think, in this book is you put them in context of the larger story of what God's doing in the world that helps us understand them. So I have a special interest in these miracle stories because I think about how wrong understanding impacts very real people and people who are precious to me, who are grieving the fact that they didn't get the miracle that they hoped for someone they love. So perhaps you could begin just by talking to us in a general sense. Are there some tools you would hand to us, or some glasses through which we might should read miracle stories in the gospel, some basic understanding we should have as we read them?
Right. So I think the miracles and the parables work in a similar way to reveal a facet of the glory of Christ. And I think the way that we misread the miracles so often isn't entirely off track, right? Just the idea that God can work a wonder in your life, or that God cares about the problems that you go through, or even the pain or the sickness. And certainly what Jesus is doing in the Gospels, you know, the people that he's healing, for instance, or restoring, they're not incidental to the, or you know, coincidental to, you know, to the process. He really does have a care and a concern for them, an addressing of their quote-unquote felt need or what have you. So we're not entirely off track to think along those lines of what Christ could do for us in those. But that's really just a bare kernel of what the miracles function, or how the miracles function. in Jesus's ministry. Sometimes, so I grew up hearing the teaching that the miracles were largely about Christ revealing himself to be God.
Yes, his deity, to demonstrate his deity.
Right, which of course he is God. There's no denying that. And that's not entirely off track either. Certainly the miracles reveal sovereign power and they demonstrate that he is not of this world and that sort of thing. So it's not entirely off track, but it's really not the full story of what's happening there. So they're not necessarily attractants. Sometimes you hear people say that Jesus performed miracles to attract a crowd or to attract people to him. But then you find other instances where he said, where he tells his followers, don't tell anybody about this or what have you. So he's always, in some sense, shepherding the moment. I think the big picture, the big explanation that sort of encompasses all of Christ's miraculous ministry is that he's giving us a window into the other world, right? So in the Gospels, what we find, and particularly in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, is this recurring phrase, the gospel of the kingdom, that Jesus came preaching the gospel of the kingdom. And this is not set at odds with the gospel of the cross or what have you that, Paul and the apostles preach later. But it's sort of the overarching campaign, the mission of Christ as he is bringing his own sovereignty to bear, right? He's announcing his kingship, to put it in a simple way. The miracles, then, are demonstrations of what it looks like when Christ is king. And because it's just the inauguration of the ministry, of course, all sin isn't vanquished, all death isn't vanquished, but you're getting these glimpses, these windows, that when Jesus is in charge, when Jesus exercises his sovereignty, when his sovereignty breaks into the fallen, broken world, things are restored and things come back to order. So in one sense, the miracles look back to before the fall, before there was death, before there was sickness and so on, but they also look forward to Christ's second coming, their windows into the other world that is breaking in through his ministry.
I like what you said here. You said the miracles demonstrate the at-handness of the kingdom, and you said the miracles are acts of heavenly normalization, which is to say they are isolated snapshots of the transformation of the broken world to the way it will someday be. I think we think of miracles as the opposite, that somehow it's God breaking in, doing something otherworldly, and you're kind of making the opposite argument, aren't you?
Yeah, very influenced by C.S. Lewis in talking about what miracles are in his book, of course, where he comes at the idea that a miracle is a breaking of the natural order or, a breaking of the rules or something like that. And, he uses the phrase to say we're essentially, a miracle is we're receiving new data about how the world works, that maybe how we thought the world works wasn't the full picture. So God, of course, isn't breaking his own rules or anything like that. But we think upside down because we think of the fallen, broken world as normal. In a sense, it's normal for us. But we also know, as Christians, seeing how God created the world, seeing where he's going with the world at Christ's second coming, the restoration of all things, that our world now is not as it's supposed to be and not what it was meant to be. Therefore, the miracles are sort of glimpses of what life restored will be like, glimpses of what the entire world will look like when Christ establishes his kingship over the entire globe.
Well, why don't we dive in
to
a couple of miracle stories, and perhaps you can help us to figure out when we're handling one of these stories, how we effectively pass along to our people what's really at the heart of these stories. Why don't we begin in John 2?
Okay.
John, he's the gospel writer who over and over is talking about signs, and so many of these are miracles,
right?
Are they not? And so this first sign is a miracle. It's not a healing miracle. Something very different that's at the wedding at Cana.
That's right, the water into wine. And there's a lot of ways you can go with this. We've probably all heard different lessons. I think earlier we were talking to someone who said they heard a lesson that about parenting from Jesus' exchange with his mother Mary at the at the wedding.
And I heard a long thing one time. It was all about whether or not they used this passage to talk about whether or not people should drink alcohol.
Should drink alcohol, right.
I don't think that necessarily that's what when John was writing this.
That's right.
And it isn't that important principle for us as Bible teachers. We don't want to just use the scripture as a way to then talk about something that we want to talk about or our pet topic, but instead we want to look at the passage and we want to try to think, what was John seeking to communicate to his original readers? And even deeper than that, what is the divine author? What does he want us to understand from this? And so I guess part of that comes into this understanding of how to handle the miracles rightly.
Right. And the exchange between Jesus and Mary is really interesting. I think we can get distracted by, the over curiosity about what's going on there. And oftentimes we can misread. He seems like he's being really sharp with her and that sort of thing. And then we miss really the gist of the thing or what Jesus is really about to do and what he does. I think, the superficial level, of course, is Jesus' sort of public debut into ministry, or at least his public, a debut of miraculous ministry. And there's something phenomenal, of course, about turning water into wine. So it seems, to put it really bluntly, like a neat trick or something like that. And I remember one of the very first sermons I ever preached when I was in student ministry, I did this magic trick of turning, well, it was grape juice, but where I appeared, I write about this in the book, actually, about how I turned water into, we were good Baptists, so into grape juice.
Okay, I think you have to tell people how you did this because I found it fascinating.
Well, it's very rudimentary, and what it really entails having white grape juice. So I had a translucent pitcher full of white grape juice.
Which looked like water.
That's right, from the congregation. It just looked like I had a pitcher of water. And if you say, I have a pitcher of water, immediately they go, oh, it's water because it's transparent. Yeah. And then I had another pitcher that was empty, but in the bottom there was red food coloring.
Uh-huh.
And you couldn't see it from their perspective. So as I poured the white grape juice into the empty pitcher, it took on the color of red.
It's magic.
That's right. But the real trick is someone has to taste it. So either it's already in their head that it was water. I pour a cup. I make some poor kid on the front row drink it. What does it taste like? It's grape juice. I had effectively turned water into wine. And I don't even remember what the point of the lesson was. Probably I was teaching that Jesus, was powerful or something like that, which of course he is. I think having some really the basic tools of even biblical symbols. What does wine symbolize in the scriptures? And it's actually a really versatile symbol. It represents so much in the Old Testament, especially abundance and joy and prosperity. All sorts of things, flourishing, national flourishing, all these sorts of things. So I think that gives us a clue, or at least a window into what Jesus is doing there by providing wine and the good wine at this wedding, right? So they have cisterns of water. And I think what John is doing, this is my hunch, I believe it's borne out through study of the text and other commentaries and such, that it is Jesus essentially saying, what I bring is relief from the old way of doing things, from the old system. And in essence, if you just sort of pan up, it's basically how the glory of the gospel exceeds the glory of the law.
And you're saying that because of the contrast, these were pitchers that were used for ceremonial washing?
That's
right. Is that what you're primarily drawing that view from?
Yeah, the cisterns. That's right. Yeah. And you even see, I think, so immediately following, John has Jesus cleansing the temple. And I think those two snapshots put together give us an even better picture of what Jesus is doing in that moment. So it's not wrong to say that this miraculous event shows Jesus has power or supernatural power and what have you. It certainly does. But it doesn't go deep enough to kind of give us a window into his ministry and the point of his ministry. And in a sense, the supersession of the gospel over, the old religion or the old covenant.
Mm-hmm. So bring on to that story what we were talking about earlier in terms of kind of a heavenly normalization. Was that the term you used?
Yeah.
So what are we seeing happen here that it is showing us something, or something's actually being righted rather than being transformed and... Yeah, I'm not saying that.
Well, and I think the connection is important because many times you'll have preachers even, but sometimes scholars, perhaps on the progressive end, but sometimes it seeps into evangelical thinking, that Paul and Jesus are at odds, or what Jesus talked about in the Gospels sometimes it seems foreign to what you read when we're not really seeing how the pieces fit together, right? So you have Paul, for instance, in 2 Corinthians chapter 3, talking about how the glory of the gospel exceeds the glory of the law. That the law is glorious, but that the gospel is more glorious still, or that the law is sort of the building blocks, or in Galatians, Paul talking about the law being the tutor that trains us to yearn for Christ. And so what I think the normalization is this, is if you're trying to achieve ritual purity. You're trying to achieve right standing with God. You're trying to achieve the abundance and prosperity and the vitality, all the things that the new wine represents, through the old way or through the law, just itself. You're always going to be butting your head up against the wall of self-righteousness, the falling short of God's glory. But Christ comes, and through him comes finally, finally, the abundance and the peace and the joy and the vitality that we're desperately trying to achieve through our own efforts. So I don't think, as some would say, that it's a message that the old covenant, that the law or what have you, is bad. I think it's simply putting Christ at the center, mm-hmm. as the fulfillment of those things. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it's only through Christ that we can achieve what the wine represents.
Mm-hmm. I recently just finished a book called Even Better Than Eden, and I've got one chapter that traces the biblical theme of the bridegroom, beginning in Genesis, where we have this failed bridegroom, Adam, through Song of Solomon and the prophets that are promising, you know, your maker is your husband, and there is a better bridegroom coming. And then I went here to this John 2 story, which I think is fascinating, that the first time he appears, there he is. He is at a wedding, and the bridegroom of this wedding has failed. And then we see Jesus in contrast. He is the true bridegroom, and he's the one who brings the very best of wine.
Yeah.
So because of that, when I read a little statement, you quoted someone in your chapter, that when I read it, I thought to myself about the chapter of my book. I missed that. It's dark. It's already gone to press. Yeah. I can't add it. But you wrote in here, Jesus is not performing a neat trick. He isn't just supplying a need. He's signaling the immediate presence of the ancient promise. John Prior says, it's the wine of the eschaton. And that was kind of mind-blowing for me, because I've seen other miracles that way, like that Jesus is pulling back the curtain, showing what it's going to be like the king comes, when his kingdom, when our prayers for your kingdom come, your will be done, are answered in full, and the king rules and reigns. I've seen that in the healing miracles, but I hadn't seen that as in this kind of miracle, that he is, in a sense, with this miracle, he's giving them the taste of the wine that's going to be served at the marriage supper of the Lamb.
Right. Isn't it interesting? The Bible effectively begins with a wedding and ends with a wedding. So it would make narrative, literary sense for the Lord's public debut in ministry to be at a wedding.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. All right. How about another one?
One of my favorite miracles is really sort of two miracles in one narrative, and I love the way in the Gospel of Mark chapter 5, the healing of the woman with the bleeding issue and Jairus' daughter, which to me, just as a literary piece, is so well done, so well constructed, even in Mark, which is a very fast-paced and kind of, for lack of a better word, blunt gospel. But I remember preaching through this and just finding it so rich and so helpful. So to paint the scene, of course, Jairus is, you know, a military official. He's come to Christ, asked him to come heal his daughter. On the way, I'm cliff noting the story here. On the way to respond to this request to heal Jairus' daughter, is this moment as the crowd is pressing in that Jesus feels some of his power go out of him, right? So there's a woman who has been bleeding, has this bleeding issue, and she reaches out and grabs a hold of the hem of his garment, and she is instantly healed, and he stops and he speaks to her. I find really interesting, so in that pause, right, this is an urgent request. My daughter's going to die if you don't come. And of course, she does die. While, you know, I don't know if that's something that Mark is trying to draw out, that the pause gives time for her to die, and then the miracle of the raising becomes even more pronounced. But there's almost a compare-contrast thing going on, and I see several levels at which this plays. You have two people who, in a sense, are requesting healing. You have the man who is important and an official, and he comes right to Jesus directly. He believes that Jesus can heal, and he believes that Jesus will heal in some sense, that he's bold enough to say, ask to his face, "You must come heal my daughter." Then you have the woman who is unclean, at least culturally, religiously, culturally untouchable. She is socially, in a sense, considered refuse or what have you. She's the lowest of the low. You have people on opposite ends of, you know, the social scales here. She also believes that Jesus can heal her, but she's not sure that he will. Maybe inside she kind of, you know, feared, I'm going to have to steal this blessing. Mm-hmm. I know he can heal me. I just don't know if he will. So you have two people who opposite ends of the spectrum, both want healing, both need healing. They approach in two different ways, and they both receive healing. That tells me a few things. Number one, your social status or your worthiness is not what prompts Christ to act on your behalf. Simply your neediness, your depth of neediness. It also tells me something about the relation of faith to healing. Of course, this is physical healing we're seeing here, but I think we can draw a parallel to salvation, which is to say that it's not the strength of your faith that saves you, just the truth of your faith. You can have a weak, small, tiny faith, as that woman did. I believe he can heal me. Not sure if he will. So she has a true faith, but it's very small, and yet she receives the same measure of healing as Jairus' daughter. That's important to me as well. And then the fact that he's going to heal Jairus' daughter, but in this moment as he's speaking to this woman who probably suffers the shame, having been discarded, and he calls her daughter as he's speaking to her. All of that put into one is just, so you have, of course, the miracle of the healing, which is another picture to the restoration that Christ will bring, especially at the consummation of the kingdom at the end of days. But in the midst, you have these great, wonderful, deep lessons about faith, that it's the strength of Christ that saves, not the strength of our faith. That it doesn't matter where you are on the socioeconomic spectrum or where you are religiously or anything like that. If you come in faith to Christ, he will not turn you away. And in fact, will embrace you as a beloved daughter or son of the Father.
So, Jared, say someone came to you and they said, I thought that if I had enough faith, I had people tell me that if I had enough faith, that my child would be healed. How would you use this miracle story or one like it to respond to that person?
Yeah, I think,
Or would you even go to a miracle story?
I don't know if I would
that.
Go to a miracle story, yeah. Simply because it would be very difficult to draw a straight line there. I might speak to the moment where Jesus is asked about the man born blind, which is a miracle story. Why is he? Is it his sin or his parents' sin? Which in their minds is sort of a connection between the healing and faith or righteousness or what have you. And Jesus discards all of that and to say, it's not because of his sin or their sin, but that the Father might be glorified in this moment. I think one of the difficulties we have today, especially as we read the gospel accounts, is wondering, why doesn't this stuff happen more often today?
Yes.
And of course, there's some Christian camps that say, oh, of course it does, and what have you. But, just looking realistically at the people we know in our own lives who do not have small faith. In fact, probably because of the sanctification that the Lord has wrought through their suffering, have a tremendous faith, a stronger faith than those who have lives of ease and comfort. And we wonder, why don't you do these things like you used to? And one of the lessons I think we learned through the Gospels is that the miracle isn't the point. Christ is the point. And to get hung up on these workings of wonder is to miss, by looking at the signs, what is being signified, which is Jesus himself. Mm-hmm. And I think that, that comes even through one of the parables that he told about the rich man and Lazarus, where, in the midst of that narrative, you have the idea that if someone would come back from the dead, if there's a resurrection, if they could see that, then they believe. And no, in fact, what we're told is if they won't believe the scriptures, if they don't believe the law and the prophets, then someone coming back from the dead will not convince them. So it's not a miracle that we need. It's Christ that we need. And salvation, is miracle enough for us.
So you're talking about this sense that there are so many miracles during this time in the Gospels, and people wonder why there aren't more today, or are there? But I think also, if I remember correctly, in your book, you don't just focus on the miracles in the Gospels.
Right.
You go back, because it's not just in the gospel. Certainly in the day of Jesus, there's a concentration of
right.
them. But what are some of the things that we learn about miracles and this miracle, wonder-working God from Old Testament miracles?
Yeah, Yeah, well, I think it's largely about the provision, God providing for his people. We certainly see demonstrations of the power of God. The miracles in the Old Testament do seem to function in a different way, or at least they, I don't know if they're more dramatic, but they
maybe
have a bigger panorama.
Maybe we should talk about what some of those are.
Okay. We have the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire.
Right, so in the time of Moses, there's a concentration of miracles.
Right, water coming out of the rock and those sorts of things.
His staff becoming a snake.
That's right. Or in the days of the prophets, right? So fire pouring out of heaven to light up, you know, wet altars and that sort of thing. The miracles of Jesus seem much more personal. They're not any less powerful, of course, but they have a lot to do with this sort of, there's a relational component to them. They don't seem as visibly or extensively dramatic as the miracles in the Old Testament. I also think that we sometimes have a misconception because we have this condensed record, a chronicle of the highlights, that they happened more often than we think they did. Because we're sort of seeing selections from history or the record of God's historic acts or mighty acts through history, and because they're in these pages, we think, oh, there's a miracle every day. Something, you know, miraculous happened. And I don't think that's necessarily the case. So sometimes that can be misleading. We misread sort of the historical record there. Yeah.
So there's this concentration of miracles at the time of Moses. And then, interestingly, a concentration of miracles surrounding Elijah's ministry.
Right.
This great prophet. We don't continue to see those kind of miracles throughout all the prophets.
Right.
So, yeah, and then there's this next concentration of miracles during the ministry of Jesus.
Right, and you, in a sense, cease. I don't want to say the miracles cease, but there's a sense of them trailing off as you progress through Acts as well. So certainly we would expect the physical, you know, the incarnate word on earth during his public ministry, you see all of these, you know, mighty acts that are taking place. Well, after his ascension, the apostles, they're working miracles, and there's some really astounding things that the Holy Spirit is doing through them. In their ministry, but as you keep going through Acts, they seem to become few. You know, they're fewer and far between. And then by the time Paul and, you know, Peter and so forth are writing to the churches, you know, they mention these things here and there, but it doesn't seem like a normative or routine thing that these people are just seeing these mighty acts all the time. Mm-hmm. So I think we need to not discount, of course, the specialness of having the incarnate Son of God walking physically amongst us, and how that might be, for lack of a better word, a disruption of business as usual.
I remember at one point being taught, and I found this helpful, and I appreciate if you would either critique it or improve upon it, that as we look at the miracle stories, let's say you mentioned the man who was born blind and he's able to see, and we look at that, and that one thing we should see is just the sense of him being able to, that it's a miracle of physical sight, and yet it's pointing to a deeper spiritual miracle that he sees and understands and embraces who Jesus is. Or similarly, with the man who is let down in the roof and he is paralyzed, there's the sense in which he is unresponsive to God, and the miracle is that he is able to respond to God, you know, to walk, and that is the deeper miracle. Or like the woman that you talked about who has been hemorrhaging for 12 years, the life is draining out of her, in a sense. And the miracle shows the restoration of life to a person. Is that over-spiritualizing? Is that somehow diminishing the intent of the gospel, of the miracle stories in the gospel, or is that coming closer to understanding them rightly?
I think it's getting closer to understanding them rightly. Again, to see that the miracles are not to terminate on themselves, but to terminate on Christ, right? So everyone who got a physical healing still later died. Even those who were resurrected, right? You know, Jairus' daughter and Lazarus and so on, they had to later die. So we're even seeing that in these mighty works, these mighty acts that Jesus is, you know, performing and orchestrating, that we can't terminate on those, that those are still just signposts, as wonderful as they are, as miraculous as they are. What Jesus is also helping us to see is, you trust in me and you will never die. that the greater miracle is eternal life, not simply being able to see again or having your leprosy healed or what have you. And I think we see it. One of my favorite miracle stories is the feeding of the 5,000, in particular in John chapter 6, where he makes that point really explicit, actually. So you have this, of course, the miraculous feeding, you know, a few loaves, a few fish, and to feed this gigantic crowd. And then he goes on to preach and say, okay, look, you've got your bellies full, but in a sense, implicitly saying, in a sense, you're going to get hungry again. If you really want to live, you have to eat my flesh and drink my blood. And they all leave. They're so offended. They're so disgusted by this teaching. They're offended by the good news, actually. So Jesus is there, in effect, saying, I'm glad to work the miracle for you because I care about you and I love you and I want to meet that felt need for you. You have to eat to, quote-unquote, live. But if you really want eternal life, if you really want to be satisfied, you really want to live forever, you have to have me. I'm better than the miracle. So I think we always run astray from the point of the miracles when we focus so much on the miracles that we miss what they are pointing to, which is the sufficiency and supremacy of Jesus.
It seems a bit that there's an escalation of the miracles as we read through the Gospels. We see this girl who has died, and Jesus shows up, says, no, she's just asleep.
That's right.
Rise up, right? But then we get to John 10, 11, and there is one who has died, this one who Jesus loves. Mm. And the big issue is there, he's been in the grave for 3 days.
That's
and
right.
He stinketh, right? And so that seems kind of to be getting toward an ultimate miracle.
That's right. Yeah, it's building, of course, up to the transfiguration and, of course, Christ's own resurrection. Similar point. I think, what's interesting is, I don't know if you're a fan of The Princess Bride, but do you remember,
Miracle
Max and he's just mostly dead, right? well, you get to Lazarus. No, like he's totally dead. He is stinking dead. And, I think you have, of course, the depth of love there, and that this is not just some person in need of healing or need of resurrection. This is Jesus's friend. So you have that added grief that he, in essence, cares for his friend. He cares for his friend's sisters. They're his friends as well. And, so there's there's always a, personal stake in what Jesus is doing. But here it's so, there's such love there. But it's another example of that Christ is a conqueror of death, that even death is not more powerful. Like the ultimate enemy that we have, the final answer to, for us, the thing that every man and woman in some way, shape, or form is trying to combat and, outrun and what have you, it's going to get us all in the end. And here's Jesus saying, I am mightier than that. Mm-hmm. And another snapshot. I mean, in a sense, it's a raw deal for Lazarus, I think, assuming that he's in the presence of the Father.
Have to die two times.
That's right. I mean, I was having a good time, he's thinking. But it's just, it's the doorway into Christ's ultimate conquering of death through his own resurrection.
Mm-hmm. I think it's important in these miracle stories to point out the obvious is that people who were died and resurrected, they died again.
Yeah.
People who were sick eventually died. There's a sense in which we're seeing in the miracle of Jesus, we're getting little tastes and glimpses of the complete, abundant, pervasive, permanent healing that is to come when Christ the King comes again. Because if we look at the miracles, we get very excited about them, we want them, but we have to say that as many people as Jesus healed, he didn't heal everyone.
Right.
The healing wasn't permanent, and it wasn't pervasive. It's, if you look at the map and where most of these things happened in and around Galilee, it's in this small area. But yet it's giving us, it's like pulling back the curtain, helping us to see what this world will be when the King comes again.
That's exactly right.
And this healing is permanent and pervasive, and when he heals everything for all time.
That's wonderful just to think about.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think it's just another reason or another motivation not to get hung up on the miracle, but on the miracle worker. Because of that reason, I mean, even some of the people he healed, we don't assume that everyone that he physically healed, you know, exercised faith in him and were saved eternally, right? I mean, they may have, you know, enjoyed that physical healing for the rest of their natural life, but we don't assume that their hearts were close to him. So even today, when those of us who suffer, or like the scenario you mentioned earlier, if we were to say, yeah, we want this healing, we want this miracle, and God may grant it or he may not, but the, you know, the ultimate satisfaction is to know that this is just, as Paul says, a light momentary affliction compared to the eternal weight of glory that is coming. And it doesn't mean that God doesn't love you if he doesn't grant this. You know, think of Paul again himself, you know, with the thorn in the flesh, praying, Lord, take this from me. And for the Lord to say, no, I'm not going to grant you this healing or this deliverance from this affliction, demonic or otherwise, because my grace is sufficient for you. And I think for a lot of us, when we can really break through to understanding that the permanent, eternal grace of God granted to us is better than an earthly miracle, then we're on the right track.
Well, before we go, Jared, would you just speak directly to those who might be listening? Perhaps they're working through some of the Gospels that are so sprinkled with these stories. Is there a word of encouragement or instruction you would give them that would help them to handle these texts rightly?
I think you're on the right track when the summation or your final understanding contributes to beholding the glory of Christ. That really is the point, not just of the Gospels, but of the Christian enterprise, that we would be satisfied and you know, find Christ supreme and lovely and saving for us. So don't terminate on the signs themselves. Let the signs point you to the Savior, the signified. I think when you see the glory of Christ more and more clearly, then you're understanding the miracles rightly.
Thank you so much, Jared.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Help Me Teach the Bible with Nancy Guthrie, a production of the Gospel Coalition sponsored by Crossway. Crossway is a not-for-profit publisher of the ESV Bible, Christian books and tracts, including The Storytelling God and The Wonder-Working God by my guest today, Jared Wilson. Learn more about Crossway's gospel-centered resources at crossway.org.